So I want to start this evening's talk with a little parable about meditation. So in this little story, there's a man walking through the forest. And off in the distance, he hears a splashing noise. He's walking along the path down through a valley, big trees around and ferns, very beautiful place. And then he's just splashing. He thinks, well, there must be a pool there. I wonder if there's something in the pool. Maybe an animal is there. Maybe there's something's fallen in there or something. So he goes down carefully to have a look, and he sees something very strange. He sees there's not an animal in the pool, but there's a lovely forest pool there and another man in the pool. And the man's jumping around the place inside the pool and like pushing on the water, putting his hands on the surface of the water and then pushing down, and putting his feet on the water and pushing down, and constantly jumping around the place and wearing himself out. And so first man comes along and says hello and so on, exchange pleasantries, and then says, well, excuse me, I hope you don't mind me asking, but I was just wondering what it is that you're doing here. And the second man says, well, I'm cleaning the pool. He says, pardon? He says, yeah, I'm cleaning the water in the pool. You see, the water's all muddy and stirred up, and I'm pushing the dirt down to the bottom of the pool. He says, really? He says, but there still looks like quite a lot of dirt stirred up there. And he says, yeah, I will have to keep working. And he says, doesn't it, you know, when you're pushing the dirt down, doesn't that stir even more dirt up? He says, well, yeah, that just means I have to work twice as hard. So the first man says, okay, well, look, I've got another method for you. Do you like to try another way of trying this? He says, no, I'm perfectly happy with this way. He says, go on, try this other way. He says, no, I'm perfectly happy. He says, go on. He says, well, all right. He says, what's the other way? He says, well, you need to get some things for me. You need to get some wood, some nails, a hammer. You need to get some palm leaves. And you need to get a flask of tea and two cups. And that's it. He says, really, is that going to make the dirt settle down in the water? He says, absolutely. It's a very special technique. It's been handed down since ancient times. He says, well, all right. So he goes off. He gets the wood, gets the palm leaves, gets the flask of tea and two cups. He comes back, and the fellow gives him instructions, and he makes him build a seat. And then on top of the seat, he builds a little shelter, and he uses the palm leaves to make a nice roof for the shelter, so they've got shade. And so he makes this lovely seat, which is looking out over the pond. And then when he's finished, then the first man says, okay, well, let's sit down together and have a cup of tea. And so after doing all that work, they sit down together, pour out a cup of tea, and then look back at the pond. And of course, while they were building the shelter, the pond's got clear all by itself. And all the dirt has settled down to the bottom of the pond, and the pond's beautiful and clean. And so they can sit there and enjoy that while they have their cup of tea together. So the meaning of this parable is the man who's floundering around in the water trying to fix things is like most of us when we try to meditate and we try to purify our mind. We think we can do so by making it right, by fixing things. We think we can get some kind of technique. We can do some kind of retreat. We can find the right teacher. We can find the right trick. Maybe we can find some kind of glasses with little LEDs that sort of flash in line with the rhythms of our brain or something like that. Or we find a pill. We find something we can do that's going to make our mind still. And the second man who comes along is like the Buddha, who comes along as the great teacher. And the building of the heart is like a meditation method. So this is the Buddha's instructions, is what to do. And so the meditation method is something that you do in order to distract yourself from meditation. Say that again. The purpose of a meditation method, the only purpose of a meditation method, is to distract you from your meditation. Because the more you get involved with your mind, the more you're trying to do things and fix this and fix that, adjust this and adjust that, make this right, then the more you're just like that man floundering around in the pond, raising up all the dirt and the mud. So the Buddha gave us something to do. We can watch our breath. We can say the words of metta. We can look at a candle flame. We can do any of the other many meditation objects. I don't know if you've noticed this, but it always seems to me quite curious that when you're meditating, and it's like meditate, 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 and then it's almost like you turn around and look behind you, and your mind's got peaceful all by itself. So this is the nature of conditions. Conditions are impermanent, they're anicca. Whatever emotions that you feel, they're all impermanent, they all pass. And sometimes we can be so consumed with anger, my guts torn up. You feel like you've got to scream. Sometimes you do scream. Terrible. You feel like you're going to die, and then it passes somehow. Sometimes we're consumed by grief, and then it passes. We're consumed by desire. We've got to have someone or something, and it passes. So this is the nature of all things, and particularly the nature of the mind, is that everything in the mind will pass. Everything is impermanent. So that means that there's no need for us to still the mind, to do anything to make the mind peaceful. Mind becomes peaceful all by itself as long as you're not stirring it up. So as long as we just content ourselves with building the shelter, that means just following the meditation instructions, watching the breath, developing the metta. Don't worry about your mind. The mind will get peaceful all by itself. And don't be always checking it. Imagine if that man had been trying to build the wooden shelter, and every time he tried to put anything in, he was turning around and checking, is the water clean yet? Is it clean yet? Is it clean yet? He'd never get the job done. Do your meditation method absolutely perfectly. Do it the best you can. Throw yourself at it. Keep on doing it. Keep on developing it. Take it further and deeper than you would ever have thought possible. And then at the end, when it's all finished, you turn around and look, what's happened? What has my mind become? What have I become? There's this sense in Buddhism, I believe, that good is somehow stronger than evil. That even though there's so much suffering, pain, ignorance, defilement, hatred, all of those things. So Buddhism's very, very open and very upfront in acknowledging those things, not trying to deny them or explain them away. Unlike theistic religions always have a problem with evil, because you have to say that on the one hand that God is good and created the world and the world is good, and on the other hand you have to explain how there can be evil in a fundamentally good world. And I believe that it's ultimately impossible to do so satisfactorily. From a Buddhist point of view, you simply don't have that problem. The world is as it is. We don't posit that the world is ultimately evil or ultimately good. But nevertheless, there's a kind of sense that somehow good is stronger than evil. For example, there's no concept in Buddhism of absolute evil. But there is a concept of absolute good. Nibbana is a supreme happiness, perfect happiness. There's no corresponding anti-nibbana. You can't have a nibbana of evil. It doesn't work like that. So somehow the force of good is somehow stronger. Or else even in cosmological terms, in terms of rebirth, if you, like someone like Devadatta, for example, is like the most evil person known in Buddhism, and he gets born in hell for an eon. But if you practice jhanas, you can get born in very high heaven realms for many eons, not just one, but many. So in that same way that the power of good is stronger. and even Devadatta, as evil as he's supposed to have been, he's never felt to be beyond redemption. Actually, the Theravadan tradition says that in the future he'll become a Pacheka Buddha. So there's always a power of redemption. And so from that point of view and from that perspective, there's a sense that we can trust our mind. And this is particularly so when we have at least a reasonable grounding on the foundational aspects of Dhamma. So we have a reasonable sense of right view, understand karma and morality and so on, good and evil. We have an understanding of that, we have a relatively wholesome mind, we're not sort of obsessed with jealousies and so on. And we have good precepts and good sila. So we live a life which is, for the most part, harmless and wholesome and good, and it only brings happiness to people, not harm. So when we have a basis on all of those good qualities, then when we come to meditation, they give us like a foundation and a confidence that our mind will gradually over the long term incline towards what's good, incline to development of the path, incline towards Nibbana. So we can trust our minds. As long as we have those good foundations and we have a at least reasonable degree of mindfulness and so on, if we're really too confused and deluded, then this isn't going to work so well. But for most of us, it will, for the most part. Just to trust our mind. We understand that the mind is tricky, that it goes here and there, that it thinks about this and that, that it doesn't want to do what we want it to do. We understand that, okay? But that doesn't mean the mind's bad. It doesn't mean that we're bad people. It just means that we're not perfect. It just means we still need training, that's all. So we keep on teaching it, keep on training, keep on pointing our mind in that direction. Perhaps the reason why this works so well, and perhaps the reason why the power of goodness is greater than evil, is because the nature of the mind is to know. It's essentially what the mind is, it's a knowing device. So the mind knows, and knowing is a very positive thing in Buddhism. To know things, to know, to have wisdom, to understand, to comprehend is very, very positive. So of course the great evil, the start of all evil in Buddhism, is ignorance, unknowing. So we trust the nature of the mind, and that nature of the mind is to know. As long as we don't stop it from knowing, as long as we don't distort the knowing, as long as we keep the mind healthy and keep things moving in the right direction, then that knowing will come. But knowing and wisdom happens in a way that's quite mysterious, and which also happens in a way behind our backs, just like that parable. Where does the answer come from? Ask a simple question, what's 7 plus 8? So somehow in the mind there pops up the answer. 13. No, not really, I'm only kidding. Well, where does the answer come from? How do you know what the answer is? Where is it in your mind that actually adds 7 plus 8? Why, we sort of ask ourselves a question and somehow the answer appears. It's like it's magically produced somewhere behind a screen and then pops out. Oh, it's 15. Very curious, isn't it? The way this knowing works. Because so much of knowing is unknowing. Yeah, we don't know how we know. Just the answer is there. So there's obviously something going on behind the scenes. What exactly is going on, it's a bit hard to say. But what we see in the surface of things, and we see the problem, we see the doubt, we see We can ruminate about it, think about it, and so on, and then there's the appearance of an answer. It's like if you ask a calculator, what's 7 plus 8, and you see the question, and you see the answer, you don't see what's going on inside the calculator. So it's very curious. But this is another indication, another suggestion to us that there's something inside us which wants to know, which wants to find the truth, which naturally will assimilate things, take things on board, process them, reflect on them, and so on, even without us knowing about it, and then come and present us with the answer. And just like even that very simple mathematical problem is presented to us in a mysterious way as an answer, but spiritual insight happens in exactly the same way. It somehow just comes. You turn around and it's there. Where has it come from? Why is it there? I don't know. It's just there. Somehow you know. And there's that feeling of when that true insight happens, it comes with a feeling of absolutely irrevocable confidence. And I think this is the reason why the stream enterer is said to be one who's overcome doubt. Because when that strong, incredible perception of the truth happens, how could you possibly doubt it? It's so vivid and so apparent. And so when that insight comes, then there's no question of, wondering about it, or, I mean, you can wonder about it, there's no question of doubting the actual experience itself. Of course, there's still a process of assimilating that, figuring out how that fits in with other things and so on, but the thing itself is just there, it's present to you as a moment of insight. And that kind of insight, when it's real insight, has a measurable and a meaningful effect. It doesn't just, it doesn't just sort of pass through your mind, but it affects you at a very deep level. It affects your emotions. There'll be a kind of dropping away of worry or anything like that. There'll be a stillness there. With deep insight, it cuts through, and there's a stillness at the heart of it. It runs very, very peaceful when it has insight. So after the insight happens, there's then, sometime afterwards, there's then a period of reflection about that, assimilation of it, thinking about it. What is that? Trying to understand where it fits into the path. Was that an insight into impermanence, or why did that come, and how does that fit with that, and so on. And so there's that, the mind naturally will want to think and reflect about it. But that's different from the actual experience itself. There's no reflection, no thinking there. It's just insight, just knowing. And so that quality of experience of true insight is something that arises when there's a balance of the powers of samatha and vipassana, the tranquility of the mind, and also the investigation, inquiry. And there's the stillness, clarity, the depth of consciousness comes from the samatha practice, and the incisiveness and the questioning, the analysis comes from vipassana. When the two come together, it's just a knowing, a very still, very clear knowing. And so this is when you sit on the seat and drink your cup of tea and just watch. And you look at the water, you realize the water actually gets clear all by itself. It's the nature of mud to settle on the bottom of the pool. And then when it settles, of course, you can see everything that's happening in the pool. You can see the fish swimming around, the frogs, you can see the weeds growing in there. So this is the reason I'm talking about this evening, is to give some kind of perspective about how we should relate to a meditation method or to our spiritual practice. If we are too caught up in, too obsessive about the details of our system, of our method, then we're kind of missing the point. So So, you know, when you do breath meditation, some people will count from 1 to 8 and then back again. Some people will recite Buddha, 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 or use different kinds of techniques to help with that practice. And it's not about those techniques. You know, you just use whatever's useful. And so a meditation method really is nothing more than a collection of tips, practical tips, which meditators have found useful. So if we're, this is where you see people get quite a bit silly about meditation methods sometimes, arguing about what's the right way to practice and these kinds of things. But the other problem, the other extreme, is if you completely abandon the meditation method. If you just sort of wallow around vaguely and then think you're meditating. Just sit there and just whatever comes up. That's not proper meditation. Meditation has to have its like boundaries and direction. It has to have a sense of definition to it. Meditations where you just are completely open and let whatever happen. Those meditations can be very good, but they need to be done in a conjunction with a more structured form of meditation that will give the mind the clarity and the discipline that it needs to be able to effectively practice those kind of more open meditations. So don't take what I'm saying as an excuse to just be lazy and not be careful and diligent in developing your meditation. And even though I speak like this about meditation methods, I've followed the same meditation method since I've been ordained. And I keep practicing that same method today. And for the very simple reason that it works for me. It's very effective. I've never seen any need to change it or to do any other technique. But I don't mistake the technique for the results of the technique. I don't mistake the stages of doing metta and the different techniques and so on. I don't mistake that for the actual feeling of metta, the result of the practice. So when we're practicing, The purpose of the method is to guide us along what's wholesome. Okay, so for example, we do metta to guide us along that way and to overcome dosa, that's opposite of anger. We do the breath meditation to try to still the mind and opposite of having a scattered mind. So there's like a dualism there. We've chosen the good and we're trying to develop our mind in the way of the good, and trying to abandon the bad. But there's also another aspect of meditation, which is that non-dual aspect or non-judgmental aspect, where you're not judging the good and the bad, not distinguishing. Well, you can distinguish between them, but not discriminating between them. It's like it says in the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, the mind that has greed, hatred and delusion, you know the mind that has no greed, hatred and delusion. In either case, you know, you bring awareness to it. And so those tendencies towards evil within ourselves, the tendencies to harm, we just know them. We accept them. We don't be in denial of them. Especially when we're Dhamma practitioners and it's very easy for us to think that because we've been practicing meditation for a while, or because we've ordained, or because of this or that, that we're very pure and we don't have these feelings anymore. And so we go into denial. We pretend that we don't have them, and this is very, very dangerous. And it's especially dangerous for those of us who've ordained. Because if you can't accept and acknowledge your own bad tendencies and evil or harmful or dangerous characteristics, then inevitably you'll tend to act them out and you'll tend to manifest them in your spiritual life. It will turn into what the dark side of monasticism can be, becoming someone who's controlling, arrogant, exploitative, some manipulative, always sort of assuming that one's right and everyone else is wrong, and sort of believing when people put you on a pedestal and come and bow to you and all of those kinds of things, just believe that you're actually worthy of that. You actually deserve it. How foolish is that? So we have to have this consciousness, this awareness of those bad qualities within ourselves, just to know them. Okay, that's how that is. Still got a bit more work there. And we know them and then we get on with life. We don't dwell on them, we don't obsess about them. Don't make a big deal about it. The problem with guilt and so on is because the I becomes involved, and there's a desire to punish, and there's an identification. I'm a bad person because I'm the doer of this. And whereas actually the way of practice is just to recognize it. Oh, okay. And you just get on with life, get on with your practice, and just recognize. As Venerable Antonio said very nicely the other day, that you know, you can say, well, it's bad, but it's not all that bad. That was a really terrific attitude to say, yeah, there's a clear recognition. Yes, when there's a fault, there's a fault. But it's not the end of the world. You know, what are you going to do? Keep obsessing about your faults all the time? Recognize them and move on. And so sometimes we tend to focus more on those negative things rather than... And they stick with us. And at our ABCAP weekend the other day, and Kong was saying that the study suggests that if you say a critical thing to a person, they'll remember it very easily. But if you say a compliment, then they tend to forget it very quickly. And in fact, to make somebody remember a compliment, you have to compliment them 5 times before they'll remember it. Because if you criticize them just once, they'll never forget it. And when you compliment them 5 times, you don't just have to say, you're nice, you're nice, you're nice, you're nice, you're nice, you're nice. That's 5. But you have to say, like, specific things to compliment them for. And you have to do it sincerely, and you have to do it with, you know, making proper eye contact and so on. And keep on saying it again and again. Things in. So this is something about the nature of the mind. I was reminded of the story that Ajahn Brahm told when he one time had to kind of... I think it was the story that he told us when we went to see him in Sydney last year, and he said that he'd accepted some award or something, and when he'd accepted it, he said, oh, I don't really deserve this, and so on and so forth. And then he went back the next year to see the next person got awarded the award the following year, and he said exactly the same thing. Oh, I don't really deserve this. Ajahn Brahm said, that's ridiculous. Of course he deserved it. That's why he got the award. So if anyone compliments you, say, yeah, that's right, I really deserve that. I really am a good person. And if someone gives you a criticism, you say, I don't deserve that. Just to sort of balance things up. So it's that just acknowledgement of that evil or that dark side, but just to have the trust that the good side will win out. So the good guys do win in the end. So this is what Jung talked about in his psychology. He talked about, like, you know, being aware of the shadow or integrating the shadow and so on. And it doesn't mean sort of, you know, that you have to be a bad person and do evil things in order to be, you know, that's not the goal. But it's simply to accept that those things are there, to understand them, to not pretend that they're not there. And so we tend to create this social persona. When you interact with people, we're nice, we smile and say hello, even if we think they're a complete and utter bastard. Hello, how are you? And actually you don't care how they are, and then they start to tell you how they are, and you're thinking, oh, shut up. You've got this kind of persona, and in a sense that's natural. That's just like the kind of polite ways that we go about our, you know, human interactions. But it's when we start to believe that persona. And again, for monastics, this is very, very easy to do. We can start to believe our own monastic persona. So this is one of the, this is why it's important not to be, not to, this is why I'm I'm somewhat suspicious of people who look too much like the perfect monk or the perfect nun. I get a bit suspicious of it. I remember one time I was in Thailand at this this little branch monastery, in a very, very poor little village. It was some day, like Katina Day or something like that, and we were having an evening chanting. And this visiting monk came, and I must admit, I was very impressed by this monk. You know, he had his robe on really nicely and carried his yam well, and he did all the right things. You know, when you put down your yam, your monk's bag, you know, Wat Pa Phong tradition, it's the only one where they actually have the training that you actually fold the handle over neatly. Every other monk from every other tradition, you just put the bag down and the handle flops over, but the Wat Pa Phong, you fold it over neatly. You can always tell Wat Pa Phong trained monks by how they put down their bag, right? This is one of the tips. Just bear that in mind. And so he put his bag down properly and had everything right. I was very impressed, you know. But I remember afterwards, you know, and I commented to the abbot there, Longpo Hom, and I said to Longpo, "That was a really, you know, he's a really good monk, a really rip-roy, very well presented monk, and so on." And Longpo didn't really say anything much, but he just sort of, you know, I could tell from the way that he looked. And maybe a remark or something that he said that he felt that this monk was basically kind of a showman. Maybe he knew him before or knew where he was at or something like that. But he was sort of coming and you know, making a bit of a show. And Paul was a bit kind of cynical about what was going on. So that was like one of the little lessons that I got in my monk's life. So it's not too difficult to do that. Yeah, it's not too difficult to put on the show when you're in public, to wear your robe the right way. Well, okay, that can be a bit difficult, but it's not that difficult. And to learn how to bow in the right way and do all of the right things. And so you can create this persona, but what's actually going on inside? And so we should keep that sense of vulnerability and honesty and fallibility as monastics as well. There's a time to do all the right things. There's a time to come together in a formal meeting like this and we all bow properly and to all of those things. So there's a time for that, but then there's also a time to be able to let that go, just to be natural, to be normal, be who you are. And that was one wonderful piece of advice that I got when I went to Ipoh. I was staying in the cave there, and one of the women who was a supporter there, and she said that to me, "Abhante, just be natural, be who you are." No one had ever said that to me before. And it was quite a revolution, or a revelation for me. Just, oh yeah, I don't have to be anything, I'll just be who I am. That's good enough. That's the starting point anyway. And so if we have this confidence that with the knowing mind and the way of the Dhamma that we're practicing, that things will tend to work out okay. The things that the good will tend to prevail over the evil. We have that confidence. Then we can relax about things. We don't get so upset when things don't turn out right. So that's my little talk for you this evening on good and evil. And I offer this for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Sanno Bhagavato.